Welcome to River Cafe Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
A conversation takes place every Thursday morning between me and Cary Fukunaga. It begins like this. What are we going to cook on Sunday night?
You called it dramatic. It does look like a murder scene. It's like you're trying to hide the body of the fish. It's somehow been revealed by the elements.
It is a whole fish covered in salt. It's kind of an eccentric recipe, isn't it? It is kind of weird. Ever since February 21st, when Cary came back to London to direct the series Masters of the Air, we have cooked dinner together for the same group of six friends for 24 Sundays.
I hadn't thought about it as being dramatic before I picked it, but I suppose there's a whole theatrical element to it. I remember seeing the way people do it in Italy, for example. You know, and they sit there and they crack open the salt, and it's a whole process. And then using the two spoons, you know, slowly pulling off that soft, juicy flesh that retains all of its moisture.
You are destroying the evidence.
Afterwards, especially.
Yeah. You can say when you serve it and then you crack it open, maybe nobody would know that.
All the best food, you destroy the evidence.
You destroy the evidence. Right now, if my voice sounds hoarse, it's due to celebrating the premiere of No Time to Die, including a screening in Monaco, where we all planned not just what to wear, where to stay, but what we were going to eat. Cary flew on to New York for more Bond, and the first text I received from him was a photo of a tomato sauce he'd made on arrival. Everyone knows Cary is a great writer and a great director. I know Cary is a great cook. Your mother was Swedish and your father Japanese.
I mean, my mom was like a Midwestern Swede, essentially, you know? And so like for her, cooking was like, I think, very Midwestern. But like for Christmas, her gift to people would be doing a Swedish meatball mix, you know, and give the sort of spice package away to people so they can make, you know, Swedish meatballs. My dad had kind of his go-to favorites. One of the things, like when I started going to friends' houses and seeing how other people lived, it was different, was that no matter what my dad made, it could be spaghetti, he still had rice with the meal.
Spaghetti with rice?
Always rice.
Always
on the side.
Rice, yeah. You
know, always white rice on the side and in the rice maker.
Yeah.
All the time. And then in the morning, there was always rice, fried rice for breakfast. So.
And did he grow up, was he born in Japan or in
the United States? So he's third generation, which makes me fourth generation. Mm. And my grandparents are considered Nisei, second generation, but they're kind of a special class because they were sent back to Japan for their education. So it's a different name, which was Kibe. And so they're more Japanese, I'd say, than American. They would speak Japanese to each other.
Do you speak Japanese?
Like my dad's generation, they understand it, but they can't speak it. And then my generation, if we speak it, it's because we learned in school. So I studied after university and lived in Japan for a while. I was teaching English and French and snowboarding. So it was great. I was living in Hokkaido, which was like a really...
Did you say snowboarding?
Yeah, snowboarding.
So you were in the ski area of
Japan. Hokkaido, like the Northern Island.
Is it very regional, Japanese food? Would you have a different kind of...
It's very regional,
What was it like there?
Well, it's a lot of fresh vegetables, soba especially, which is a big part of New Year soba. Uni, a lot of uni from Hokkaido. Yeah. So it's just seafood in general. But I would say the buckwheat and the uni are like the two things I think of when I think of Hokkaido. After Hokkaido, I think Kyushu for me has like the next sort of most distinct sort of food.
Where is that?
Kyushu is an island in the south. My family's from the southern part of Honshu. They're from the last county, the bottom of Honshu, which is Yamaguchi, which is right next to Hiroshima. And Kyushu is kind of in that region. And Kyushu, for example, one of the things they're known for is, aside from also a lot of different fish and produce, is horse meat, for example.
Oh.
So horse sashimi is a specialty there.
Really? What's that taste like?
I really like it. You know, it comes in a kind of a, you dip it in sort of a sweeter soy sauce, sometimes with like, you know, green onions.
Interesting.
It's not super tender, but it's also not, you know, it's similar to beef chuck. I remember I had this moment the last time I was in Tokyo for work where I was at a kind of a group dinner and there was a guy sitting across from me that he was half Asian like me. And I think he was trying to have one of those like who's more exotic kind of competitions with me. And I didn't realize it was happening until he was kind of like, you know, like, what's the weirdest thing you've ever had or eaten? And I was like, I think the two strangest things I can imagine eating are either like whale blubber or spiders.
Okay.
And whale blubber is in Alaska. A buddy of mine I was in film school with who's Inuit, and you eat the whale blubber when you're on the ice because it actually has a lot of calories in it. It keeps you warm. And the spider was kind of an anomaly that when I was traveling in Cambodia late 90s, actually with the Japanese guy that I met in one of the hostels, we were motorcycling across the country. He wanted to detour to this town that was known for its stir-fried sort of spiders, these giant spiders, which to me tasted like crab, soft-shell crab.
I was going to say, there's we eat crab like spiders, but not a spider like spider.
But he wanted to one-up me, and he's like, well, have you ever had horse
and you said?
I said I hadn't, you know, and he was really satisfied that he'd eaten a lot of horse and I just wasn't sure really... Did he win that competition?
I think he won that competition.
He won that competition,
I think,
didn't
he? Maybe. I hate to say that you might have lost, having played cards with you, that you might have lost that competition. But what did spiders taste like?
The ones I had in Cambodia were so covered in sauce. They mainly tasted like the sauce with a kind of a crunchy texture with the white meat of the spider inside of the legs. The body was pretty gross, I have to say. Yeah. It wasn't mine. Maybe it's an acquired taste.
Welcome back to River Cafe, Table 4.
I was in Mexico in January.
And Lucky you.
I was in Nayarit, so it was on the Pacific coast.
Yeah. Do you love the food of Mexico?
I do. Actually, I realized when I was there how much I missed it.
I was shocked by, not shocked, but the only Mexican food that I'd had before I went to Mexico was that kind of Mexican food where you get so many dishes on a plate and it's also heavy. And then you go and it's so... It's so clean and refined, and I love the breakfast.
When I made Sin Nombre, we were based in Mexico City a lot. And when we drive to the studio, a lot of the early morning sort of commuters would stop at these vendors and get in line and order this like sort of steaming milky drink. And I didn't know what it was. And I asked our location scout if we could stop one time and have this. And it was a kind of a cornmeal drink with cinnamon and sugar. It was just delicious. And from every day on after that, I would stop. My breakfast would be to have some of that.
Did you cook on set?
They have this thing in Mexico you do with your crews, which is different than the States, which is you work a 6-day week, but the 6 day is just a half day. And at the end of the half day, it's not a written rule, but it's an expected rule that you have what's called a snack. And a snack is not like peanut butter on toast and hand it around. It's beer and tequila and a cooked lunch. And the entire crew kind of basically gets drunk together and hangs out, and you sort of, it's a bonding moment. You get your, any kind of tension that was building up out for the week. And then I'm sure a lot of new relationships started out of that as well. But the snack was like one of the best parts of the filming week. And then you had the rest of Saturday to recover and Sunday and then start working on Monday. And, you know, usually like the rest of Saturday was usually driven by Pache, our production designer, leading the parade into, whatever kind of shenanigans Mexico City offered on a Saturday. It's like really common, I think, in Latin America to not eat dinner until after 10 p.m. or 11 p.m. And I was talking to a friend of mine about, they invited me over for brunch. And the idea of like breakfast and the between breakfast and lunch is brunch and there's lunch. And they had never heard of the term linner.
The term what?
Linner.
All right.
Which is lunch between lunch and dinner.
Yeah.
Right. Which then got us thinking about, well, then what's between dinner and breakfast, and then it's just dickfest. And then we realized that dickfest really was the 2 or 3 a.m. food you had after going out to a bar or a club or whatever. And now, at 1 year of lockdown, none of us could remember the last time we had dickfest.
Yeah, when did you have dickfest last?
I really don't think it's got to be at least 3 years now, because I was also just working so hard before lockdown. But actually, that's not true. On our night shoots, we had dickfest.
They had dickfest.
We had 4 or 5 a.m. meals. But in Mexico, what I loved was, after a hard night out, you'd go, there was a couple places you'd go. So either like, if you're in Guadalajara, you'd go out and you'd have tacos made of tongue, like 2 or 3 in the morning, which are just delicious, like really, really tender meat, and a great way to sort of like cap off, whatever hangover you might have the next day. But in Mexico City, you'd go to this place. It was like called the Blind Goat or something like that. And you'd have tacos al pastor.
What's that?
It's al pastor would be the one that's sort of, you'd probably equate it to the kind of shawarma you'd see in the Middle East, where the meat's cooking on a vertical skewer, slowly rotating. It has a pineapple on top, But I think what really makes it popular, it's the sauce they put on top. And it's kind of like a brown sort of pepper-driven, chili pepper-driven sauce. And it's just so smoky and delicious and rich. And with that little bit of pineapple, the meat, and that sauce and the corn tortillas, it was like the perfect
way. What time in the morning would that be?
Anywhere from like 2 to 5 a.m., you know, until the sun was coming up.
Do you go to restaurants when you're filming? Do you like it? No, I used to come to the River Cafe.
We came to River Cafe as often as we could. You know, we used to have our kind of like every now and then a kind of crew catch up dinner just to, you know, get all on the same page while having good pizzas and wine. And
Do you work over food? Do you like have a meal out to just, you would do that, but would you?
We ate in a lot. We had a lot of late dinners at Pinewood, you know, on Bond, where the producers and Daniel and I would be there working on the script and just trying to sort out all the kind of, you know, dilemmas we had in front of us just to get through it.
Are there dinner scenes in the movie? Are there food scenes in the movie?
There is a food scene in the movie. It was an interrupted food scene.
Because in True Detective, my favorite of all time, there's a scene where he's with his wife, with Matthew McConaughey. He is in a diner and there's no food. And they're talking about something really personal about
He's at a scene with Michelle Monaghan, kind of deeper in that diner. But early, I think in episode one, he comes over to dinner at Woody Harrelson's character's house.
And he gets drunk.
He drinks a little too much. Or he shows up, I think, a little bit drunk. Yeah. But what was interesting about shooting that scene is Woody, for example, doesn't eat meat. In fact, he's vegan.
Right.
And we were having spaghetti. And so we had to figure out a different set of noodles for him. And we ended up using these kind of spaghetti squash for his. But I remember when we were shooting it and he was chewing and talking, you know, spaghetti squash has a distinct crunchy sound, you know, when you're eating. And so in the scene you have this, actually I find it's a really pleasing sound, you know, as Woody's eating his food, it's got a nice kind of like hearty kind of like, you know, jaw you know, cutting kind of sound to it. And everyone else kind of has that sloppy noodly sound, you know, as they're eating.
Did Jaina have a food?
The home economist who makes the food on a movie. And we had an amazing one on Jane Eyre who made this ham, this sort of Christmas ham for a scene when Blanche Ingram arrives with this big party. So the house is sort of a buzz preparing all the food. And they had this ham there. And we're prepping the scene. I just happened to take a little slice of it just to see how it tasted. And it was probably one of the best hams I've ever had. And over the course of the scene, that ham got smaller and smaller because I couldn't stop eating it. And I liked it so much, I literally sought out the home economist after we're done just to get the recipe to that ham because it was
Did
so
she give
good.
It to you?
She did, yeah.
Oh, let's make it.
I've never made it, but I want to,
Okay, if you have it somewhere, we could try it.
Definitely
try and make it, I was trying to think about food in movies. I mean, again, it goes back to the drama of the sea bass and salt and the drama of feeding people and the drama of watching them respond. You know, your creativity is there forever. We can watch the first movie you ever made and it lasts. And I often think that I make something I'm really proud of and then it's gone.
That's right.
No, it's over.
It's very different, right?
You cook and then they eat it and then it's sort of
it's over.
Done. It's over, you know.
There is something I think more meaningful in things that don't last.
Yeah.
Because you're forced to appreciate it in the brief moments it exists. And there's the immortality of film. So if you think about like Sunset Boulevard, Gloria Swanson walking down the stairwell saying, I'm ready for my close-up. She will always be that age for the people who watch that film, you know, even if she's long gone. There is something special about it existing forever, but then because it exists forever, sometimes people may not watch it because they can just keep pushing off to a later time. Whereas a great meal, you can't delay that. You have to appreciate it while it exists.
And also it's memory, isn't it? I mean, just when you were talking about your father or your mother or going to a restaurant, it's the memories. I was trying to think when we met, and it was a dinner. It was very bizarre. The River Cafe was actually cooking the meal.
That's right. That's right.
And it was a dinner for Jake Gyllenhaal, and it was given by Cartier.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was a very fancy dinner.
Jewelry shop. And we were sitting there.
Yeah, Bond Street or something.
Yeah, in this fancy place. Yeah. And I remember I was introduced to you, and I said, well, how long do I have to wait until I tell you that the first season of True Detective changed my life or whatever? But I think that it's nice that we met over food, and we talk about food. Yeah. And then I think the first text message that you sent me was a photograph of tomato sauce that you've made. And
specifically
then
the butter part of it.
That's right.
The step, which I don't know if I could say that out loud, if that's a family secret.
You can say it.
But the secret is dropping in that stick of butter right before it's being served and the Pomodoro sort of pasta mix in the pot, you know. And I don't know why it tastes better, but because it's butter, probably.
Butter tastes butter good. Just, but what, yeah. Did that, had you made it before, when you used to cook before?
I never used butter before. No. That was I walked away from that dinner we had, which was different dinner, but like, oh, I'm going to use this. Yeah. I knew I was going to use this again. I actually asked another common friend I have with Jake, which is Greta Caruso. Asked Greta for advice, like on a little napkin. We were at a dinner trying to figure out what's the best shape of the kitchen for someone like me who's not a professional cook by any means, but I like to cook and like to have people over and cook for multiple people. I think during lockdown, a lot of people experimented with different kinds of cooking and baking and whatever. And I remember as lockdown was easing and people could come over to the house, I decided to make ramen, like tonkotsu ramen, which was like an 8-day process to get that stock and everything, you know, done by scratch. And then when you actually serve the ramen, you kind of have to do the noodles right before you're serving a bowl, and all these other sort of ingredients have to go in. Everything has to be timed pretty precisely. And I'd never done it before, but I wanted to get it all right. So that was actually pretty stressful. And like, I'd just done Bond, and I don't think I'd ever felt that much stress as I was preparing that bowl of ramen and hoping that it, you know.
And did you, how many was it for?
I ended up making like 8 bowls of ramen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I still had enough like stock for about 30 more people.
Yeah.
I think that kind of killed my cooking routine for lockdown. Yeah.
It's like people making a lot of bread in lockdown too, weren't they? I think people made a lot of food that took a long time, that took the process. And certainly for the first lockdown here, you couldn't buy flour apparently anywhere because everybody was making bread.
Yeah. And because everyone was alone, you'd try to like do almost like virtual meals together. Like my dad and I did a virtual meal where we cooked the same thing, but like, you know, I'm obviously ahead of his time zone. So it's my dinner, his lunch. And then like India and I did a pasta for my lunch, her dinner, you know, where we cook the same thing. So it feels like we at least got to eat together.
But what about your father and cooking? What was it like growing up? Did your father cook when you were growing up?
So my
dad, was he the cook in the family?
He was the cook in the family. And like, he was the one, when we talk about careers or jobs, right? He always had a job, never like a career that he loved. And I think he always dreamed about opening a restaurant one day, which never happened, but like enjoy cooking for lots of people. And one of our sort of like bonding things when I was a kid was like trying to guess the ingredients of a meal at a restaurant. And so really to sit there and taste the food and to try to break down its particulars. There was this Cambodian restaurant we used to go to when I was a kid that had this one special kind of pork chop that had like the best glaze. And we were always trying to figure out, you know, what were the elements, you know, in the sauce that created that flavor.
Do you still do that?
Try to guess the flavors?
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, do you?
Yeah.
Because I think there's a real palate, you know, I think of how, I mean, it's interesting even with wine, how people, you know, that thing. I used to go on wine tastings with my, again, with Rose, and she would say, you know, this wine tastes of chocolate and cigarettes. But it's all to do with the, you know, the memories and the associations and the taste of food. And so I think that what we're, you know, talking about sort of being together and food and memories, there's also the sense of comfort of food. There's excitement. You're such an adventurous eater. I mean, I have to say that, you know, I think you're a pretty adventurous person, but you certainly are an adventurous eater, you know, spiders and, you know,
whale blubber.
And, no, we didn't have the horse.
That's
so I'd like to meet your friend. He, on the scale of adventure, he probably does win. Yeah. But you are an adventurous eater. Yeah. And that's really, that's it. It's fabulous.
Well, you know, I don't know if I do it for the experience or the clout. It's definitely from curiosity as well. I mean, the whale in particular, I'll never forget what whale tastes like.
What did it taste like?
Well, there's blubber, and then there's different kinds of fermented meats as well, you know, and one of them is you ferment, whether it's seal or whale meat, you can ferment it in its blood. And that's probably even funkier. Like the blubber is kind of mellow compared to that, but that taste of whale blood, that iron heavy whale blood is so strong that when I went to Nantucket years later, and I went to the Whaling Museum in Nantucket, I could smell the blood on the presses in the museum that hadn't been used in 150 years just because there was enough residual, you know. And if you've never had whale blood, I don't know if you could connect those two sensations. But
so it stays in your state. That's again back to the memory. But did you like it? I mean, did you like the taste? Is it something that you thought, this is really delicious?
Would I seek it out? Probably not. Like, is it one of those things where, oh man, I really wish I had some whale blubber right now.
Yeah.
I don't think that would ever occur. But it really was, when we were out in -30, -50 degree environments, it kept you warm. It really, you felt the heat coming from inside you. But I mean, yeah, I would still say as adventurous as those things sound, my everyday sort of cravings are quite normal, I think.
What do you crave?
I mean, pasta I could eat almost every day.
Yeah.
And I love sashimi and sushi. Mm. I think those two things are what I eat probably around, you know, the course of a week pretty often. Probably eat too much pasta.
And if you said for comfort?
For me, it would probably be fried rice. Hmm. And it goes back, I think, to, you know, my dad for breakfasts, you know, watching cartoons or something when you're a kid and having a bowl of fried rice. And it was the most, if I told you the recipe, it doesn't sound even Asian at all because it involves ketchup.
Ketchup?
Yeah. And I found out much later, I mean, for me, that's just what it was. That's fried rice. But obviously later, contextualizing where that came from, what it came from was, so my grandparents were in the internment camps during World War II. And my father was born in the internment camps as well as my uncles. And so you were given certain rations in the camps. Mm. In fact, my grandpa was a cook, one of them. And mayonnaise, ketchup, those kind of ingredients were quite common. So you make new recipes out of what you're given. You just make do. So my dad grew up on a fried rice that wasn't made with soy sauce. It was made with ketchup. And it was really basic. You use whatever vegetables or meats you had from the night before with the rice, put it all together and cook it up. And my favorite version was the simplest one, which was just bacon, onions, and then put an egg with a yolk, you know, still runny on top. And that to me is like the epitome of comfort food. Mm. But strange that the legacy goes back to an internment camp.
Would you make it now?
Yeah, I make it pretty often.
Yeah, make it often. Yeah. Yeah.
I just like, even when my dad would use other vegetables in it, like you do like the real proper way of doing fried rice, I still prefer just the onions and bacon.
And the bacon. Yeah. So would it be the rice, just plain rice?
So whatever you'd made from dinner the night before, you keep that rice. Mm. And this is something else. In my family, we just left the rice out. You didn't put it in the fridge and the next morning. And someone told me later on, you're not supposed to do that.
In restaurants, that's like a big no-no.
Yeah, because apparently it's toxic.
They say the bacteria in rice is almost worse than anything.
But I think if you grow up eating it.
You grew up eating it.
It doesn't really affect you. Yeah. So you know, I would leave my rice out all night and the next day. Yeah. You know, you make the fried rice, and then usually there's so much fried rice.
So what do? Put oil in the pan, and then you take that rice?
No, I use the fat from the bacon. So I start off, you know, I cut the bacon in pieces first, and then I slow cook the bacon so that the oil doesn't evaporate too quickly. And then salt and pepper the bacon, and then add the onions, and then I add the rice, which is usually in big chunky bits because it's been sitting. And then you squeeze a bunch of like farting ketchup on the top of it. And then you chop it up and get that going. And then once it's kind of mixed to a nice sort of a light red pinkish color, bowl it up. And then separately, you can just cook some eggs to slap on top. It's really quick.
Okay. Well, now I've got some expectations of when I come and stay in your house that we're going to have
some fried rice.
We're going to have the fried rice.
I'll make sure to put the rice in the fridge.
Spiders, maybe. We could have the ramen. We could do that. It sounds, you know, you're a great cook. You're a great director and you're a great friend. Thank you, Carrie.
Oh, thank you, Ruthie.
To visit the online shop of The River Cafe, go to shoptherivercafe.co.uk.
River Cafe Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.